Capital is a sprawling epic of a novel by the English writer John Lanchester. It follows his non-fiction book, Whoops, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay, about the institutional greed and stupidity that led to the global financial crisis, what we used to euphemistically call the credit crunch. Before that, he wrote an extraordinary, deeply personal memoir, Family Romance, about his late mother's secret former life as a Catholic nun. Capital is his first novel in a decade. It's set on Pepys Road in the London suburb of Clapham, a once working class, now gentrified street, where fortunes have been won and lost, and where the lives of its residents are seemingly utterly disconnected, despite living cheek by jowl. It's the contemporary urban experience. And the novel begins in December 2007, just as the first shudders are being felt in the global financial crisis. John Lanchester, welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Morning, Daniel.
Now, when I started the novel, I was expecting something about the global financial crisis, kind of literally, I suppose, but Capital's much more about the social impact of the meltdown, and it's written in the lives of the characters.
Yes, I mean, the global meltdown is really the backdrop to the book. It's not the subject of it. And one of the reasons I ended up writing a non-fiction book in parallel as a kind of companion piece, or a kind of benign tumour, I suppose, on the back of the novel. It was because I thought the specifics of the crisis were interesting in a kind of non-fictiony way. But in the novel, I wanted to write about the textures of ordinary experience and talk about the lives of these characters and the feel of the city today.
Hmm. And, I mean, there's quite a cast of characters. I sometimes felt like, a bit like London, it's a metaphor for London. This book is quite overcrowded. There are a lot of characters.
There are a lot of characters. I got very interested in the way that London is now a sort of microcosm of the world, that global themes and global pressures appear in London in a sort of large structural way, because London is the global capital of finance and finance is really central to the story of what's happening more or less everywhere. Mm. There's a lot of inequality in London. That's a really global theme too. And also just in a very basic and literal way, if a part of the world, I know you're familiar with this phenomenon in Australia too, if a part of the world blows up or kicks off, suddenly you have a lot of people from that place arriving on our doorstep. So, you know, Somalia implodes, and then next thing you know, there's 250,000 Somalis living in London and the southeast. And I was very interested in that way that, you know, the world presses on London, and then I wanted to imagine a novel in which London then in turn presses on this one particular street.
Mm. Now, Pepys Road, which is very much central to the novel, you don't describe every resident of Pepys Road, you edit your characters, you choose the characters quite mindfully. How did you come to that process of editing in and editing out?
It was more to do with the people who snag your imagination and the stories that get you going. Mm. I didn't want to try and be representative, because I think that's a danger for fiction. You know, it's then a bit like electing delegates to represent different union factions. You know, if you think, I've got to have one of them, got to have one of them, got to have one of them. And next thing you're in a way strangling the book by doing that. So it was the people and the stories that you know caught my imagination, wouldn't leave me alone. One of the characters is a parking warden. I've forgotten what you call them here. You use a different term, don't you?
Traffic warden.
Traffic cop. Well, no, it's because it's parking specifically. Mm. So,
she's
a Zimbabwean asylum seeker. And again, I got very interested in traffic wardens because they combine two things you don't normally get together. They're invisible, and yet everybody hates them. Mm. I've always been interested by that. And asylum seekers also have that dual nature that, you know, people don't want to look and don't want to think about them, and yet they're fiercely resented. So that story sort of caught me. And I was interested in football, you know, in Premiership football, which is a very important thing. You know, I often say London is the capital of the three Fs, football, finance and fashion. And that football is you get in a cab anywhere from Mumbai to Shanghai to Dhaka to Buenos Aires, and they're talking about Premiership football, and that story interested me. And so it's not kind of conscious editing and selecting, it's just the things that grab you and won't let you go.
I do want to talk about the character of the traffic warden, Quentina. She's a stateless person, former political activist from Zimbabwe, and yet deliciously she spreads fear and confusion. That's the term that you use when she walks up and down Pepys Road.
Well, as I say, this thing about traffic wardens really interests me because they're completely essential to the healthy functioning of the city. You know, the arteries would clog
particularly
up.
A city like London.
Yeah, I mean, it would just come to a grinding halt. I mean, it comes to a halt often enough anyway, as it is. But so they're essential, and yet everybody does hate them. You know, when you get a ticket, you are in a unique, you know, you're levitating with resentment at the injustice of it all. And it interests me in that a society that's so safe and so comfortable and so secure and in which so many freedoms are guaranteed, that the main thing that makes people angry is getting a parking ticket. I mean, if you live in that place, you are among the tiny fraction of the most fortunate humans ever to have graced the surface of this planet. If you're lucky enough to get angry about a parking ticket, you should just bless your fate. And that was one of the things I wanted to write about by Quintina.
And there's a moment in the book where I guess we vicariously experience the kind of racism that someone like her might endure. And it just comes from the bowels. I mean, it's an extraordinary tirade that this woman kind of unleashes on Quintina. Is that something you've seen or witnessed?
It's something you see out of the corner of your eye. You know, I think a thing about getting older and you spend more time with people like you. So I don't think I've seen... Let me think about this. I don't remember the last time I directly saw an active or heard an actively racist thing, which is quite striking because clearly it's a pattern in society. Mm. I think there's a thing about codes and signals and people are careful about doing it around people who don't agree. But there's no question there's a lot of it. And it's particularly, you know, people, again, come back to this thing about traffic wardens, people feel free to hate them. That's one of the things that's interesting about it as a category. They're in that kind of role. And certainly in the UK, I don't know about whether it's the case here, but it's a job that's always done by very recent immigrants because no one wants to do it. I mean, the American equivalent is driving a taxi. It's the last lot of immigrants do that job. And in the UK, it's parking wardens. And they do get a lot of this. They're kind of lightning rods for a lot of the free-floating rage and ill will that are around in the society.
This is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Daniel Browning and I'm speaking with John Lanchester about his new novel, Capital. Now, in your work of nonfiction, in Whoops, you tried to, I guess, explain the global financial crisis, the economic downturn, whatever you like to call it, the credit crunch, in fairly layman's terms. But this, you'd started work on Capital before the global financial crisis, and it is very much, as you said, in the backdrop to this novel.
Yes, I was looking out the window, really, and observing the street, and felt that, and there's a particular image of seeing things coming to the houses all day, you know, Pilates instructors, dog walkers, florists, feng shui consultants, landscape gardeners, builders, this is obviously a bubble, the bubble's got to pop. So I started writing the book on the assumption, this is late 2005, early 2006, that there was a bubble that was going to pop. So the book had an arc-like shape. What goes up must come down. And the reader would know that it was going to pop, I was assuming, because it would have popped by the time the book came out. And then what I thought it was a kind of local phenomenon, a property bubble, people getting carried away, you know, over the value of their houses. And actually, as I was writing it, it turned out to be this huge global systemic thing that was much bigger, much more consequential. I mean, really was coming home to roost everywhere on Earth simultaneously. So when I finished the draft of the novel, I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to use that in a non-fiction, rather than end up recasting the novel with lots of scenes where the characters kind of explain credit default swaps to each other, which I think would have made the reader fall asleep, you know, in world record time, to use the things I knew about the actual real life events, separate, kind of quarantine them and put them in the work of non-fiction, and then go back, which I did, and then went back and finished the novel. So they came out in reverse order. I finished a draft of Capital, wrote Whoops in a burst, and then went back and properly finished the novel.
Another thing that I love about Capital is the kind of the Dickensian convention of giving characters somehow names that make you think and make you remember. and one of the characters in Capital, Petunia Howe, there's the Banksy-like figure of Smitty. Everyone's names seem to kind of give you a clue about their character. Roger and Arabella Yount?
Yount. The Yount's name was a problem, actually. I spent a lot of their time figuring that one out and looking at lists of surnames. And it was a great relief when I came upon it.
And then there's their spoilt and neglected children, Joshua and Conrad. I mean, I love it. It's such a Dickensian thing.
Thank you. Well, I do like that about 19th century novel. I mean, I like lots of things about 19th century novel, and it was a conscious model to follow, partly because they had, in a sense, the 19th century almost had more freedom in fiction. We've got very preoccupied by points of view, by, you know, subjects you're allowed to write about and subjects you're not allowed to write about, and by things the character could and couldn't know. And I was very struck by the fact that, you know, writers of Dickens' time, in a sense, almost had more permission. It's odd that the 19th century, we think of ourselves as being freer. But actually, from a novelist's point of view, technically, they were freer. They could be omniscient if they wanted to. They could pop in and out of characters' consciousnesses. They could talk to the reader directly. They really could do whatever they liked. And I did have a conscious sense of, all these sort of technical rules I've absorbed, I'm just going to junk them and just absolutely write exactly what I feel like at any given moment in terms of what the kind of rules and permissions and frame of the imagined universe was. And that was very liberating to, you know, think as if I was writing in 1850.
I mean, London is the capital of the title, I suppose, but it's also obviously about the economic system. And you spend some time describing, you know, the lesser-known parts of London. And for me, I got a sense of the rigidity and the structure. I mean, there's the chaos of London traffic, there's the tube network, the kind of relentless, you know, going to and coming from. London's kind of the snorting elephant in the room in this novel.
Yes, and it is a squeezed place, you know, I wouldn't deny that. And it's a hard place, and it's increasingly, and this is a trend I've been in London 25 years, and it's consistently gone in this negative direction, that it's a place where richer people have a nicer time, you know. And if you don't, you do need money to kind of cushion the hard edges of London in a way that wasn't true, I think, 30, 40 years ago. But it's getting truer virtually by the week. And I regret all those things. And, you know, there is just very simply an enormous number of people in a not very big space, and that does exert pressures. But from the writer's point of view, that means there are stories everywhere. And I've always been fascinated by thinking of when you walk down a street, I have a feeling of, I wish I knew what was happening in that house now. I wish I knew what was going on in their lives. I wish I knew how they got to this point and where they're going, and the kind of accumulated sense of all those stories in all those houses as you go along. And one of the things I wanted to do in the novel was give you, you know, actually take lift the front off the doll's house and give you the chance to actually, you do get to find out what those stories are.
You certainly do get drawn into the lives of the characters. Do you ever feel like there could be too many characters? I think in Capital, you're still introducing characters at about page 300. But do you ever feel that you can overpopulate a novel?
Oh, it's absolutely possible. That's not a complaint I've had from many readers. I did try and manage it quite carefully.
I'm not complaining.
No. But in terms of the sort of balance of it, you know, that is a thing you have to think about. If you want to give a feeling of a human press in a place, you have to have a bit of a human press in the book, I think. But it is one of the things I spend an awful lot of time thinking about in terms of the architecture of the book and who you meet when and how much you get to know of each story and the sort of rhythm of moving between. There are three or four families that are at the heart of the book. There's an Asian family who own a corner shop. There's a banker and his wife, and there's Petunia, who's the last person to be born in the street, who's still living there. And they're the kind of, in a sense, the pillars of the book, those families and the stories around them. And I spent an awful lot of time, before I sat down to write the first sentence, I'd spent almost as much time on the architecture as on the writing of it, and it was on exactly that point of the balance and rhythm of the kind of movement between the different characters.
I mean, I say it's this, it's set in the London suburb of Clapham, but that's not abundantly clear in the novel. But is it set in Clapham?
It is, pretty much. I didn't want to. I thought it was distracting to be too specific. Yeah, and yeah. Pepys Road isn't a real road.
No.
And it conflates various. You know, there are things that are quite like the street I live in, but except the houses aren't like the street because our houses are smaller. And there isn't a corner shop in our street because it used to be a garage there. So I borrowed, you know, it's a conflation of a bunch of different things. But the basic demographic of the street and the way that that demographic has shifted from aspirational working class neighbour to a neighbourhood that, you know, put simply is full of bankers. I mean, that's a really crude version of it, but that is sort of what's happened. And that's, you know, roughly what happened in the novel, and it's roughly what's happened in real life.
And one of the most evocative, I guess, parts of the novel, in the very very beginning, I think, and perhaps in the prologue even, you describe how the houses are like yawning mouths that have to be constantly fed, and you described it earlier, just before. That's where the idea came from?
Yes, I was walking down the street and walking around and pottering about, which is my normal working method for starting a novel, and got really interested in that thing of, you know, as if the houses had become people in their own right. And a thing that really stuck with me was explained by an engineer. I noticed that once people started digging out their basements, which is the current fashion in London, it's going to stop quite soon because people realise that it's going to make the houses fall down. The penny hasn't dropped yet. And once they start digging out the basement, because the earth is compressed so by the weight, you get far more volume out than is actually there because it expands to something like five or six times its original size. So once they start digging, it goes on forever. Mm. And this image lodged in my head that it is as if the earth is throwing up, you know, but throwing up the weight of the bankers living up above it. And that was one of the places where the book started, that image.
And that was an episode of Grand Designs. It was very much in this part of London. People were trying to build in a very confined space and build this massive entertainment area in the basement. And the city just kept throwing up clay and, you know, so much refuse, you know?
Yeah, dead Roman legionaries from 2,000 years ago. No, it is extra. I didn't see that episode of Grand Designs. But it's really sick. And by the way, in real life, what... in my experience of that always happens is by the time you finish, because it always takes three times longer than you think, and it's unbelievably disruptive for everyone around. By the time they finish, the neighbours hate them so much that they sell and move anyway. I've seen that happen in the area around us. The three or four people who've done that all had to move because you know, it took 2 years and no one was speaking to them.
Oh, dear. Smitty, the Banksy-like character that I was talking about earlier, he kind of anonymously makes street art and he sells through a commercial gallery. He also drives a BMW. In kind of drawing his world, the London art world, I think you go to town, really.
Well, I really enjoyed that. I mean, it's one of the things that's changed in London, the extent to which it's a centre of art as a business. And a lot of it's in the East End. It's not around where the novel's set. And I got really interested by that because it's a properly new thing in the last couple of decades, this whole world of art, which often overlaps, I think, with marketing. In some respects, it's almost more like marketing than it's like art. And it is make no bones about it, it is properly a business. Mm. And a business with a lot of absurdity and excess and silliness. And also, I think you'd have to say, fun in it. And I did want to write about that. And it's been strange, actually, Smitty, because when you're writing a book, you can't tell who people are going to like and who they're not going to like. And I really like Smitty because I like his sort of energy and his cheekiness. But he's one of the most disliked, in terms of people I hear back from, he's intensely disliked by lots of readers. They really can't stand him. And I was very surprised by that.
I wonder what the reason for that is. I mean, I'm drawn to him. I guess there's some of his personal characteristics I don't like, but I'm fascinated with the world he inhabits.
I think it's a really interesting world too. And I do think, one of the things people don't like about him is a thing that's true about people who succeed in that world, and is that they do play it. Mm. You know, they take a kind of a game-like view of what they're doing. And I think that's quite an effective way of succeeding in that London art world, to essentially see it as a game you're playing. Smitty is entirely that person, and I think that's one of the things. That's why I think he was fun to think about, but it's also, I think, a thing people dislike.
In some ways, I feel like everyone in the novel is a bit of a refugee, that they're all fighting to belong. Some of the characters convince themselves they're just passing through, and then at the end they acknowledge that they're there for a time. London can be a transient place.
It might be. It's very acute of you to spot that. I think that might be some of my own feeling leaking into the book. I mean, I was brought up abroad, born in Germany, brought up in Hong Kong. My dad was born in Africa, my mother was Irish. So, you know, I washed up in London. I was 25 when I moved there, and 25 years later, I'm still there. But I do have that sense of it as a place where I think one of the reasons I like it is that there are a lot of people there who come from other places. Mm. And that helps if you have that feeling of coming from somewhere else. You know, it means there are more people like you. But I am very interested in that sense of people passing through it and people sort of not sure how long they're staying. And I felt for, you know, 2 decades, I wasn't sure how long I was staying. And yet, you know, there I still am. Mm.
I feel that about every Australian city that I live in. I've lived in 3 of them and I never fully inhabit them. And I always question myself as to why.
Well, I tell you what I think about that, you know, because the Hong Kong I grew up in has completely gone. And actually, I've come to think that If you never go anywhere, never do anything, stay in the same place your whole life and do the same routine, one day you'll wake up in the morning, you'll look out the window, and you will not recognise the world around you. You know, it comes to everybody. It's a condition of modernity. You end up not knowing quite where you are and what the world is and how it's changed. And I think that sense of dislocation and displacement you're talking about, I do think it's a condition of the modern world that comes to everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think if you have that moving about side and that element of dislocation in your life history, in your biography, you just have a head start on a feeling that eventually comes to all of us.
And before you go, John, just tell us about the next book. It's a very interesting premise.
Well, I've done a short thing. It's almost not a book. It's on the edge. It's the 150th anniversary of the London Underground next year. So publisher Penguin are doing a short book on every line, 13 lines. And I've done, they asked me to do the District Line, which is a kind of suburban one that has this real spread of rich and poor across its trajectory. And, you know, after writing a big fat book, it's quite good to get back in the saddle with a short book you can finish in fairly short order. So that's the next thing that's coming out.
Fascinating. We look forward to it. John Lanchester, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
And Capital is published by Faber and Faber. This is Books and Arts Daily here on RN.